Session number 14806, Edmund Murray.
Side 17.
Well, just to recap, you're in southern China, and
province of Yunnan.
And you've asked, and the column has been marched to where was the precise location?
Pu'erfu. Pu'erfu, it's in Yunnan.
Yeah, and they're mustered there, and I think did they remain there for a little while, or?
Well, just for several days, you see, because on the 8th, as I told you, I asked to resign from the Legion, and this was granted. Now, the battalion and the rest of the regiment marched on towards eastern China, and eventually found, or were accorded a cantonment or an encampment, and there they stayed for many months afterwards before they were able to get onto, until August at least, when the Japanese surrender came. And then they made their way by train via Laokai down towards Hanoi, of course, where they were eventually to participate in the in the Vietnamese War, which we can call it, you see, and also, I suppose, to the final kicking out of the French from Indochina, which was a very, very sad day.
You said that you'd passed Dien Bien Phu, which was, largely speaking, the culminating battle of the French in Indochina. Could you just describe it, I mean, as you saw it at that time?
Well, the way I saw it, the way I remember Dien Bien Phu is that it was quite a reasonably sized village, if you like, but with quite a number of substantial buildings. When I mean substantial, I mean substantial for Indochina. They were not skyscrapers or four-storied buildings. They were just two stories, but they had roofs and they had masonry walls and brick walls and things like this. And the first thing that I noticed of any substance at all was the hospital on the right-hand side, which had been looted, as a matter of fact. But I went in there and I found a bag of sucrose, which I collared and used for, to sweeten our coffees and, to sweeten our coffees and drinks throughout the, for as long as it lasted, not only for myself, but with my the friends of my the lads in my section. And it was a wonderful thing, I'm sure, that gave us energy and sustenance. And then, but it was in an absolutely terrible state, really, was the hospital. It had no roof and most of the walls were knocked down. It had been originally decided to make a stand against the Japanese here. But then Alessandri, and I heard him talking to the officers, although we had put down stones and a reasonable defense place, and we were, the 7th Company were behind it, Alessandri told his officers that we were not going to make a stand there or make a strong position because of the fact that there are at least three or four routes into the place. And the airfield had already fallen, and so there were Japanese on the actual airfield and around its perimeter, and so there was no possibility of any further assistance or ambulance aeroplanes coming in to transport the wounded elsewhere. And so, although the 7th Company held the place for several hours while the rest of the battalion moved on towards Mali Tau, or no, towards Pong Sali, it was in Thailand or in Laos. We held the place for several hours, and then we regained we caught up with the company, but we didn't make a stronghold there. But my impression was that it was quite a reasonable sized place, and of course it was more or less in the well of a valley, and there were quite considerable heights surrounding the whole of the place, of course, which were very, very important indeed when the final battle of Dien Bien Phu took place later on.
In the Viet Minh, large guns at the top.
When the commanding officers, of course, of the French thought it quite unreasonable to suppose for a moment that the Viet troops or authorities would be able to get cannons onto the tops of these heights. But, you know, with the coolie labour that they had, they managed it, and that was the to cause the final rout of the French and the terrible sacrifices that took place.
Were the other rivers there? I don't know. I thought it was a junction of some rivers, but I can't really remember.
I can't remember either.
Okay.
I know it wasn't very far from the Namu.
Okay. Another question I was going to ask you, your medals that you have on your in France, the medal ribbons, the little miniature ribbons that you have, as is the French custom in the lapel. Do you get much of a reception from that when you're in France?
Oh, they take notice of it. And yes, there is a certain amount of respect, I'm sure, accorded to me when I go to France because of the ribbons that I wear. And especially when, and I never hide the fact that I'm English, you see, although I can pass anywhere for a French person. But yes, it's a continental custom, shall we say, to wear the medal ribbons. I find it difficult to get them. You know, I have to get a friend to go and see the draper or what have you. And so, you know, but I've got them, I think, on all of my jackets. I'm very proud of them.
Of course.
I mean, I don't have any English ones. I remember when I was in the police force writing up to the Minister of War, and I'm sure I know that someday, someplace, I've got the answer that I got, and even the envelope that I got. I told them that I'd been in clandestine intelligence in the Far East, and how long, and all the rest of it, and that I'd, you know, participated in training agents for dropping, parachuting behind the Japanese lines in Burma and Malaya, and I'd been in command of a training camp for these agents, and that although I had been decorated by the French for my war services, that I considered that I should also receive British medals and the quality and all the rest of it, I know nothing at all about. But I was a police officer in uniform and was about to obtain permission from the Buckingham Palace to wear these gongs and medals. And so, you know, could they confirm that I was entitled to certain British medals? And I had a reply from the War Office saying that services with in clandestine intelligence, international services liaison department, did not give me any entitlement to my war service for which I'd already been decorated by the French.
How nice. Yes.
And I've been proposed, of course, for the honours list on numerous occasions by various members of Parliament and from even civilian authorities. So we never had any result at all. But that was particularly for my services with Winston Churchill in 15, during which time he himself acknowledged that I'd saved his life on 3 occasions, at least.
Really? Okay. We'll come on to that in a minute.
I digressed.
No, I asked the question. Just tell me what happened then, how you made your way to British or American forces. You said there was a weather station.
Not far from Pu'er-Fu, I found that there was a weather station. But prior to that, I, of course, had to go and have some food. As the company was passing me, as a matter of fact, I was standing on a wall waving the goodbye to my company and the battalion as it went past in Kourong, this erstwhile friend and enemy. As he passed, he shouted up towards me, "Deserter, deserter, deserter," which of course was rather ridiculous. But vaguely, I suppose, I understood what he meant, that I was leaving the Legion to its own devices, you know, and going off on my own.
Did you get any back pay?
Oh, yes. Ah. Eventually, when I got to... Yes, eventually.
Okay. Did that amount to much?
Oh, yes, I got all my back pay reasonably. I mean, I couldn't argue with the result. I mean, I was paid until the day I left the Legion.
Right.
And but in this place, Puofu, I went to have a meal at one of these street-side cafes. There was no electricity. Mm. It was all sort of candles and particularly oil burning things, and so, but I always enjoyed Chinese food. But there, and then talking to them, I found out that there was a good man, a man of God somewhere. And so I eventually found this Norwegian, or Scandinavian at least, I believe he was Norwegian, and he was about 6'6", Methodist priest. And he used to run around the countryside to his different, which he considered to be his parish, you see, to the different places where there were missionaries and Christian folk. And the horses in that region are just pony size, and he could never ride a pony because of the length of his legs, which would be scraping the ground as he went along. And so he used to run, and he was apparently a fantastic runner, and he'd broken records, you know, running between the different... All these things I learned from the natives, from the Chinese people in this community of Puofu. And then he took me to the American Air Force weather station, where there was a lieutenant in charge, and we seemed to hit it off. I don't know, there might have been about a couple of dozen Americans there at the most. But they used to send up these big balloons with apparatus attached to them, and they used to go right up into the air. And then when they got to a certain height, of course, they would collapse. And the mechanisms would be, of course, come down by a parachute, and then they'd have to go out and find them, which was, you know, sometimes a bit of a hard job of work. And so the lieutenant and I hit it off fine, and I was respected, I was received and welcomed, and they put me up, and I had food in the mess with them and chocolates, and used to watch the films that they used to get, and I was really... But there, on occasions, of course, the lieutenant would come and see me, you know, and ask me to go along with him to the sort of reception center that they had, the administrative center, if you like.
But there were 15 of them there, were there, did you say?
No, I said a dozen.
A dozen, yeah. Oh, right, okay.
Not very many.
And those are the only troops around, those are the only Westerners around.
Yes.
Yeah. And you, what were you were dressed in what? I mean, had you got a pair of boots, or?
I'd found a pair of sandals.
Right, okay.
I had sandals on, and I still had my shorts, and I still had a shirt, and my forage cap I was still wearing, I still had. I probably discarded that in any case. I was young, I mean, I was, what was I, in 45, 28, which was reasonably young, I suppose. But they were all the sort of GIs, and there's this lieutenant and a couple of sergeants, and a full sergeant. But they were very, very welcoming, and I enjoyed my few days there. But then, on occasions, the lieutenant, and I'm sure that it happened at least half a dozen times, when he would call me in to be present at an interrogation of a wounded legionnaire or a European soldier, because some of the infantry, colonial infantry, the colonial army, of course, had by this time arrived there, or in that vicinity, and they were, most of them were trying to get transport to Calcutta, being wounded, having malaria or something like this.
What was the route? What was the route that they... Was it by plane?
Oh, by plane, yes, because they had a plane there.
Over the
No, not over the Hamptons. They used to fly to Kunming first of all. That was the only route that the Americans from there did.
Right.
They flew to Kunming, which was the provincial headquarters or provincial capital.
And from there to Calcutta.
And from there over the hump to Calcutta.
Then over the hump to Calcutta. Mm.
And so he used to call
the
me
humps
in.
The Himalayas.
Yes. Yeah. And what do you, you know, what now? What do you think of this case? And he used to ask me my advice on the different cases that were there presenting themselves for transport.
Right.
And there were quite a number of officers, and 75% of the time I would say, you know, and he wouldn't ask me there in front of the officers
no.
or in front of the men or the NCOs, and he would say, you know, what do you think? And I would, well, you know, 75-80% of the officers, I said, no, you know, let them walk. And there were occasions, of course, when I said, yes, that's an honest illness that he's got, or, you know, I feel that he's being honest about it. And one particular one was Lercher. Now, Lercher was Swiss, and we'd been NCOs together in Tong, and he was really in a very, very poor state. He had hardly any clothes at all, nothing on his feet, and he definitely had malaria, and he had a great temperature, about 102, 103. And so I said to the lieutenant, well, I think this is an urgent case, you know. And so he was on the next plane off to Kunming and then to Calcutta to the hospital at Chandanagore, which was a French possession in India.
Oh, really?
Chandanagore, yes. Oh, 60 or 70 miles probably from Calcutta.
When did that stop being French, then?
That stopped in... now this, I'm talking about 45, oh, 48, 50, you know.
And how big of a possession? Is this like a small Goa or something?
Like a small Goa, yes, like a Goa, like Goa.
And, how
and they had a hospital there.
How big was that? There's a place, do you happen to know?
Well, it had a big hospital, had quite a big residential population, a French population. I couldn't... You know, if you look on an old atlas,
right,
you'll
okay,
find
well
it.
Well, no, it's the first...
You know? But Chandanagore was a French possession in India, and they had another one further down. I can't remember the name, but... but in any case, that was their destination to the hospital there. And eventually, in 1946, when I came back, and I became a courier, and on one occasion I went to Switzerland with one of my buses, you see, tours, and I was sitting in the front. There was a great big V.
You were, at that point, a tour guide.
A tour guide.
Right.
Courier.
Long after the war.
Courier.
Yes. Or after the war.
46. After the war.
Just after the war, okay.
Yeah. And going down in Montreux, we had to turn left. Of course, we were on the right-hand side. I'm standing there, probably talking to the driver, telling him where to go to the, never mind, to the hotel. And I've got, 30 to 40 passengers there. And there... on the curb, on the side of the road there, was standing Lercher. The last time I'd seen him, do you see, was at Pu Wer Fu, getting onto a plane because he had malaria. And there he was. And so, of course, I couldn't stop there. I just shouted out, told him to come to the hotel where we were going. And so he came down, which was just a few, 100 yards away. And we left it an hour later because one of my clients was interfered with going up in the lift. And but I phoned up the Hotel Suisse Esplandide, which was just a short distance away. They had accommodation, were glad to have us. And so, lock, stock and barrel, we moved to the new hotel. But Lercher was there, and we made an appointment for that evening. And we went out, and he was working in the Quincaillerie Mioton, which is a hardware store, but very, very important one, you know, big place. And they were quite rich place. And so, and then Lercher told me that he told the whole story of Pu Wer Fu and how this Englishman had saved his life, and it had been in one of the local newspapers. But the Swiss people in those days were forbidden to join the French Foreign Legion.
I think they still are. I'm not probably about five or 10 years ago.
Officially, anyhow. Yeah. And so there we are in Pu Wer Fu at the weather station, and then. One day I said to the lieutenant, you knew about 5 days I was there, and I said, well, I'd like to get to Kunming. Mm. So they left. It was always against the rules and regulations, do you see, for them to put anybody else but GI personnel onto these planes. So he was taking a bit of a risk, but he was prepared to do it.
You were getting these were stragglers from your column.
If you like stragglers, yes.
These guys coming through that still managed to come through the jungle or something.
And those that we didn't take on the plane, of course, and I suppose we only took about half a dozen on the plane and maybe refused half a dozen or a dozen. And they, of course, had to continue their straggling way, if you like, towards the Mau, where the French were due to reorganize.
And there was there were no buses or trains or anything. It was completely
No question.
And the Chinese army hadn't got any mechanized transport or barracks in the area, or
there wasn't there weren't any visible signs of the Chinese army there in that area.
Not even the odd guard post or anything.
Well, the general had, there was a sort of a guard post in the rear, his bodyguard, if you like, of the general.
What was the function then of this weather station? Was it? I mean, he was lumbered with sorting these cases out, was he? The manager.
Because he really wanted to, or because I wanted to, but the purpose of the weather station, of course, was meteorological.
Right.
And they said, because it was important, being, towards the Indo-Chinese frontier and where the Japanese troops were, then, of course, they had to know what the situation was as far as the weather was concerned.
Right. But he wound up with these cases because he was the only responsible person around.
He was in charge of the station.
How did he establish your identity, or what did he think?
I didn't have any papers at all.
Decide whether these people are okay or not.
He believed me, he trusted me. Uh-huh. I mean, I can tell a good story. But he believed me.
I think we've established that, yes.
But, and then I'd come accompanied by the... By the local parson, if you like, missionary, do you see?
Right.
And he vouched for me. And then while we were there, the Americans and myself, there was a consulate, a British consulate not too far away.
Right.
And so the missionary, the lieutenant and myself, we were invited to the consulate for the king's birthday. So it must have been June by then.
Okay.
You see? For the king's birthday, and there was quite a banquet. And I remember, this big table and the consul sitting right at the top of the, right at the top of the, with his wife. And so there must have been probably 20, 25 people there, 2 dozen people. And I was specifically invited in order to recount the story that I'm telling you.
Yeah.
And, Churchill never came into it in those days. And I remember the big thing about it is that we'd been drinking champagne and we'd had a wonderful meal and all the rest of it, as is typical in embassies and consulates throughout the world. I think maybe it's been cut down a bit now, but in those days, in the time of the Raj, it was quite an enjoyable pastime, really, doing the, especially the king's birthday, because it was a king in those days. And I remember talking and drinking. And then eventually, when everything was going to be broken up, they suddenly realized we hadn't toasted the king. And so it was done as an afterthought rather than, the reason for the ceremony.
So this was about 2 or 3 weeks after you'd left the Legion.
This is within a fortnight.
And did you tell them that you wanted to? And how did you then get into the work that you then got into?
Oh, well, you see, I told the lieutenant I'd like to go to Kunming.
Excuse me. Yes, how did you get into the secret?
I'd spoken to the consul, I can't remember his name, about what I should do once I got to Kunming in order to get into the British forces, you see, because he knew that there were British forces up there, And so he said, well, go to the what's it called, the British, a British office, you see, that was in all the principal towns. I'll think of the name later on. And so, you know, when I got to Kunming, I asked there was a British presence at the American airport, because it was all American,
This was a big base, wasn't it?
At Kunming, a big base. Very big base.
Oh, that was what, very important for bombing base.
For bombing and where transport. all the transport and everything else, you see, across the hump went. And that used to be the capital of the area, and then Nanning took over. And so Kunming was very, very important. The Queen visited it, and she gave it a special name, you know, about City of Paradise or something like this.
When was that? And when the greenery. When was that visit?
20 years ago.
Okay, right.
And so there I was, the British military mission, the BMM. So I asked for directions to it, do you see, and I went there. And there was a front entrance. There were metal steps going up the back. And so I said, oh, back entrance for me, do you see. In the state I was, you know, I was really, although I'd washed and probably shaved, it would surprise me. But, you know, I was still feeling disreputable as far as my appearance was concerned. Although, yes, because eventually I got a GI's uniform. But no. At that time I was as an ex-legionnaire in Civis, with my shorts and my socks and sandals. Yeah. And I, you know, and so that's why I went in the back entrance, if you like, up these metal stairs and knocked on the door, and it was opened somebody called, come in. And inside was a captain in, I don't know what, line of business, but I know he had three pips up. And so I introduced myself, and he was amazed. Sit down. And then he called, Inge. So this beautiful, beautiful blonde girl came in, absolutely beautiful. She came in, and so he said, do you think we'd have some tea and sandwiches, or tea and biscuits? And so, you know, she came in with the tea, and we sat down there, and I talked to the captain, and we had quite a chat. But I always said, you see, that Inge, I would never, ever forget Inge, because she was so beautiful, and the tea was wonderful, you see, after such a period of time. But we talked to the captain, and then he put on his uniform and cap and all the rest, and Sam Brown, and off we went to visit another office, where I was introduced to Colonel Buchanan. Now, Colonel Buchanan was quite a bit of a character, and he, out there, I mean, they used to make their own gin, you know, from aviation spirit or something like this. And then there was a Devon lad, Ginger, he's called Ginger, his name, you know, I frequently remember it, but I often forget it too. And he was the donor of the DR, the dispatch rider. And I suppose there were about half a dozen others. And this was the ISLD group.
That stood for?
I keep on saying International Services Liaison Department.
Or is it Inter-Service Liaison Detachment?
Inter-Services Liaison Department. But it was clandestine intelligence, I learned very, very quickly. And now, so the captain left, you see, I think we had a few gins together. And then the captain left, and Buchanan sitting on one side of the table and me on the other. And I tell him about the foreign legion and things like that. And then now he said, you want to join the British forces? And I said, yes, as quickly as possible. Well, he said, there are two methods, he said, of joining us. He said, one, if you want to join the regular army, he said, with a rank of at least captain and probably major. He said, depending on, you know, what Calcutta decide, he said, that'll take probably about 3 months. Or he said, on the other hand, he said, with the same rights, prerogatives, you know, as you would have had as a regular officer we can make you a civilian officer. And I can do that straight away, right away, do you see? And so I said, well, of course, I opt for the second. And so I was made a civilian officer right away and signed forms and all the rest of it to that effect. And went through, because there was not much training taking place, really. But he, you know, he put me in the picture as far as the clandestine intelligence and the job and all that sort of thing.
So what did he actually explain to you?
What the job entailed in Calcutta, in China, what their job entailed, you know, the obtaining of information, most of which came from the Americans. But they were in close relationship with the Chiang Kai-shek organization and lots of top secret stuff, which of course was impressed upon me that it was all top secret at the time. And then, so I was there for just a few days before I went up to Kunming. And it was before I left that we came to the conclusion that I had to get into India. This was one of the trials that I was to undergo, to get into India, into Calcutta, through Dum Dum, without any papers, because I didn't have any papers.
So what was other than being in an arsenal, what was Dum Dum?
Airport. Dum Dum's the airport.
Okay, right.
And so it's still...